For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and coming up in today's show,
Claire Allen discusses her dark new psychological thriller, The Liar's Daughter.
From the archives, Janice Galloway records her book of short stories, Jellyfish.
We go back to the eve of the publication of Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine and chat to Gail Honeyman.
And then we return to Claire Allen for the books of her life. That's all coming up in today's show.
Since the publication of Her Name Was Rose in 2018, Claire Allen has built a reputation for writing gripping psychological thrillers. Her latest, The Liar's Daughter, has just entered the RNIB Talking Books Library. It's a slow-burning tale of emotional manipulation that's set in Derry, from where Claire joined me to tell me more. And a warning, the book does deal with themes that some listeners may find distressing. Claire Allen, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So the book's just gone into the RNIB Talking Books Library. Could you just set the scene for the listeners?
I absolutely could. The book is called The Liar's Daughter, and there's an elderly gentleman called Joe McKee, and we find out at the very start that he is dying. He has cancer and he doesn't have very long left to live. And quite soon after that, he does indeed die, but it may not be the cancer that got him. It turns out that Joe McKee has a lot of very dark secrets and has created a lot of enemies along the way. So it becomes then a bit of a whodunit. It's a very dark, claustrophobic read about the secrets that can exist within families.
And Joe has two daughters, a daughter he is the natural father to, and a stepdaughter called Heidi, who, though she has a very awkward relationship with her father, has been his carer in his final months.
She has, and God love poor Heidi, because Joe came into Heidi's life when she was 8. He was her mother's partner and her mother passed away shortly thereafter. So Joe looked after Heidi all through her childhood. So she feeling sort of duty bound that she should be the person to look after him now, even though the relationship is quite fraught. And we do find out why that relationship is quite fraught. So nobody really gets along particularly very well in this book, because everybody is very damaged by Joe leaving his natural family and joining this new family. And those hurts were only sort of increased as other things emerged. So it's the darkest book I've ever written. And I have to say that Joe is the only baddie that I've ever written who actually scared me. And I did actually at certain stages have to say, no, I can't write anymore. Close the laptop down and take a break from it. I think because he's the most real of all the bad guys. He's not a serial killer or, you know, somebody that's mad and crazy and struck on revenge. He's just a really thoroughly horrible person.
Yes, he is utterly irredeemable. He hasn't been pushed into what he's done. He's just unpleasant.
He's deeply, deeply unpleasant, and I don't think he even really takes responsibility for what he's done. He comes up with lots of excuses. It's quite, I should say this because I do like people to know what going into this book, because it is a very sensitive subject. There is a child abuse story in the book. I try not to keep that a secret because I know for some people that's a terrible subject. It may trigger something in them, etc. So Joe is very much one of these characters who can find an excuse for everything and can go, oh God, this was happening and that was happening and I didn't mean it and look what I've done afterwards. And at no point does he ever express regret or sorrow for what he's done. And he just compounded his crimes more and more over the years.
It's a very slow burning novel. And I wondered if part of the reason for pacing it like that was so that we can really experience the anguish that he's put both Heidi and his other daughter, Kira, through.
Yeah, when I'm writing, I do quite like to have a bit of a slow burn to start with, and then everything ramps up somewhat. But it's so important in this book to set the scene exactly how it should be. And in this book, I hope that the house, his house that he's living in, that everything sort of happens around this house. They all come to him because he's sick, he's bedridden. The house should almost be a character in itself. It's very foreboding and very claustrophobic. So I want the reader to sort of feel as if they're trapped in that space as well. And, you know, this book will make you feel uncomfortable. It's supposed to make you feel uncomfortable. But, you know, the pace does pick up as the book carries on. But as you said, it is so important that the reader knows exactly what they're dealing with this guy, because he's not very nice at all.
Now, your previous books had quite a lot of action, a fair amount of violence in them. And yet in this book, it's all in the mind. And I think one of the things I found most frightening about it is how Joe's actions silence people in just as an effective way as a murderer might do.
Exactly. He's extremely manipulative. And we do know that there are a lot of abusers who are very manipulative and they carry that on. And Joe is one of these people who's seen as so often as, you know, a pillar of the community to the outside world. He's greatly volunteered at the local library. Everybody came to him for a bit of a chat and a cup of tea. And they see him as this great charitable person who looked after his partner's child when she passed away. He's seen as a hero. But behind it all, he is pulling the strings and he's playing people against each other. And we see that time and time again with victims of abuse and perpetrators of abuse, is that they're caught up into this huge web. Their head is messed up by how these people speak, the threats they make, or their own feelings of guilt about what happened. And an abuser can play on those. So it was very important to me to get it 100% correct and to do the story justice, because so many people have been through similar. So there are no scenes of child abuse. Everything, as you say, happens in the mind. And I think sometimes that's scarier, because your mind will always go to a darker place.
The book is told from the point of view of multiple characters, and the audiobook therefore has multiple narrators. Was that a conscious decision on your behalf, that everybody should have their own voice for the audiobook version?
It wasn't. My publishers came up with that. But when they emailed me and told me that that's what they were doing, and they told me the names of the actors who were taking on the roles, honest to goodness, you could have told me they were putting them under Hollywood movies and I couldn't have been happier. I knew they were going into really safe hands, and I knew that it would make the audiobook so much stronger to have everybody with a very distinct voice. Obviously, I don't think the listeners would have resonated so much if there was a female narrator reading Joe's voice, because there are a few chapters that are Joe speaking. I think it adds an extra eeriness that we do have a narrator narrating him solely. And the two different ladies who've done Heidi and Kieran, we also have a narrator doing one of the really minor characters. So yeah, five people, it's a lot. But I think it really works. And the feedback I've got from the audiobook is that it really, really works. It's great to do that. It makes it feel more interactive and experienced to listen to, I think, rather than just the one voice the whole way through.
The back seat of my car is full to bursting. Lily is bundled up in her car seat, asleep and blissfully ignorant of the strained atmosphere between her fellow passengers. A weekend bag filled with pyjamas and underpants to be laundered, a toilet bag containing a razor, toothbrush, soap and shaving foam sits beside her. A plastic patient's property bag sits in the footwell. It's loaded with boxes of medication, dressings, instructions that I will have to will my postpartum brain into reading and understanding once we're back at Joe's house. I won't call it home. It ceased to be my home the moment my mother died, also from cancer. Unlike Joe McKee, the man who has played the role of my father for the past 21 years, she didn't deserve it. "Did you lift my slippers?" Joe asks as I help him ease his seatbelt on. He is still sore, still tender from the operation to try to remove the tumour found in his lung. Except that they find it had company, all through his body. "Riddled with it," he said, sadly, when he told me. "Yes, I lifted your slippers. They're in your bag, along with your pyjamas and dressing gown."
"There was a book in the locker, did you?"
"Yes, I lifted it as well, and packed it, along with your prayer book and your reading glasses." He nods.
"I wonder how many more books I'll read,"
he says to himself as much as anything. "You know what the doctor said," I tell him, "take one day at a time."
"Those days are still numbered though, aren't they? I doubt I'll see the spring."
He looks out onto the bleak grey car park of Altmacelvin Hospital, on the very outskirts of Derry, Belfast in one direction and the city centre in the other. The sky is almost as dark as the tarmac below us. Heavy and angry looking, it seems apt. Joe has always liked spring, more so as he grew older and found comfort in God. A time of renewal, he would say as the evenings stretched and the temperatures crept up. I know as well as he does, there'll be no renewal for him this year.
The Liar's Daughter by Claire Allen, which is read by multiple narrators. So Claire, you're obviously very pleased with the audiobook version of The Liar's Daughter. Are you a keen fan of audiobooks in general?
I am a huge audiobook fan, but fairly new to it. I was one of these people that kind of resisted it for a long time. Don't know why, just sort of felt like, I prefer sitting down and reading. But I lead quite a busy life. You know, I've got two kids, I've got school runs to do, I have a dog to walk, I'm always doing the housework, things like that. So I find that I can put an audiobook on when I'm in the car driving the kids to school or waiting outside of school for them to come out. When I'm walking the dog, earphones in, more of a book. And again, in the kitchen, I have a little echo and I have that on playing my audiobooks all the time. So my house is always really, really clean and the dog's always really well walked when there's a good book on the go, because I'll just keep going, you know, get lost in the book. I think they're fantastic and they bring books to so many people that wouldn't access them otherwise. I have a cousin who experiences sight loss, and for her, that's how she enjoys her books, and she would have been a big reader but unable to read traditionally anymore. She had gone to large print, but her eyesight has deteriorated even further since. So the fact that anybody can enjoy these books and can listen to them, and there's something oldie worldy radio drama about it that just makes them really inviting. And I love hearing narrators bring these characters to life and how much effort they put in to bring them to life. I think some people think an audiobook is just somebody sitting and reading the text. It's not. They put so much emotion into what they're doing that, you know, they are acting it out for the reader. So, yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Yes, one of our narrators at the RNIB Talking Books Library described it recently as theatre for one.
Yes, that is absolutely it. Perfect. When you get the right narrator and the right story, it's a joy. And there are certain narrators now that I will actually go on to my provider, be it libraries or Audible or whatever, and I will look for what else that particular narrator has done, because they've done such a great job. You know, you can trust them to put that through. So it's a different way of consuming books, but it's a great way and it's a very worthwhile way. And I am an addict, and it's great. It actually allows me to consume a lot more books than I would otherwise.
As we hear, you're an incredibly busy person, being a full-time author and a full-time mum. But I believe when you first started your writing career, you were also a full-time journalist.
I was indeed. When I first started writing, I did only have the one child then, and now I have two, but he was 2 years old. And I was working full-time as a print journalist for our local newspaper, which is the Derry Journal. I worked there for 17 years, and during that time I wrote 8 novels. Most of that time I was working full-time, and then I did go part-time as the kids got a little bit older and needed me more for school runs and things like that. And then 4 years ago I decided to take sort of a leap of faith and go full-time completely writing, which has been brilliant and I don't regret it. It has allowed me to really apply every ounce of my energy into my writing career. But I do miss that, you know, working as a journalist, you know, in a busy enough city, a lot of news happened in Derry over the years. You do build up quite a sizable bank of characters and ideas and situations that you can draw on for your book. So not having that to plug into anymore is a bit tricky, but just means I have to try a little bit harder.
When I've spoken to other writers who served an apprenticeship as a journalist, I am always struck by the fact that that apprenticeship has taught them there is nothing as strange as real life, that there is pretty much no plot twist that hasn't really happened.
Absolutely. And actually, there's things that happen in real life that if I put them in a book, my editor would come back and go, "Now, come on, you're stretching it a bit there." And I think one thing that I learned when I was working in journalism, one day you could be at a crime scene, at a murder scene. That afternoon you could be at a primary school prize given. Later on you could be at a politics meeting or whatever else. But what I learned most of all is that the best stories and the real heartstring pullers and everything are the ordinary people. And so many people living in our city and in our streets, ordinary people you would walk past every day, have these incredibly remarkable stories to tell, be it of bravery against adversity, be it amazing love stories. There's just so much all around us all the time. I loved being able to tell people's story, and I loved that people trusted me to tell their stories. But yeah, some of the things that you hear over the years and you just think you couldn't make it up. There's just no way.
And I believe that there is a certain poignancy to your becoming an author, because you made a promise to your deputy editor on the Derry Journal.
Yeah, when I started working in the Derry Journal, even when I did my work experience there as a 16-year-old, the deputy editor at the time was a lady called Siobhan McElhaney, and she really took me in and mentored me. You know, I did my schoolwork experience there when I was at journalism college. I came and did a 6-week placement at the Derry Journal, and then finally when I qualified I took on a staff job. And Siobhan would have pushed me harder than I pushed myself. I think, you know, I would have been nervous maybe about covering certain stories, and she'd have kicked me out the door to do it. And we had this great professional relationship, but a great friendship too. We always talked about books on, you know, sort of downtime. We shared books to read, and she always said to me, you know, someday you better write a book. And we would joke and laugh about it. But Siobhan took ill, I'd not long come back from maternity leave. And she took ill, and quite soon we found out that her illness was terminal, unfortunately. She had a very aggressive brain tumour. And quite close to the end, family contacted us and said, you know, if you want to come to the hospital and see her, please do. So we went to see her, and sitting and chatting and saying the things that you need to say in these circumstances. And you know, we did have a bit of a laugh with it. But as I was leaving the room, she said to me, you know, you better write something good for me, girl. And that was the last words that I heard her speak. So within 2 months of that, I started writing my first novel, because I just thought, Siobhan has asked me to do it. She always wanted to do it. She's been robbed of the opportunity to do that herself. And she was only 47 years old. She was a young woman. So I wasn't going to waste any more time. So I spent the next 6 months writing my first novel, and I was lucky enough to get it published. And it's dedicated to her, and I will always say, without Siobhan telling me, in that same staring voice she used to kick me out of the office with, you write something good for me, I may not have actually got around to putting pen to paper. So I credit her with it massively.
And you certainly hit a very creative streak. You've written your last 4 psychological thrillers in 4 years, and I'm guessing you've probably already got your fingers on the keyboard for the next one.
The next one is actually we just finished the proofread for it at the weekend, so it is well underway, and it's due out in January of 2021 in ebook and in Ireland in trade paperback, and then I think it'll be next summer it'll be out in paperback in the UK. So it is already very much done, and readers who have enjoyed my other books will recognise the main character in this as Ingrid Devlin, who's everybody's favourite love to hate journalist. This is her own story, and she finds herself in a bit of trouble, which some people will probably be absolutely delighted to read. She was a great character to write. So the next book is called Ask No Questions, and it's pretty dark as well, but it was fun to write. It was definitely one of those ones that just was a lovely writing experience from start to finish.
Has Ingrid been waiting to step out of the supporting role and into the main role?
Yeah, very much. She's initially in the first thriller, and her name was Rose, and I had never intended actually to bring her back in any shape or form. And I happened to be away on a writing retreat, and the author Liz Nugent was there, and we got talking, and she said, you have to bring that journalist back, she's such a good character. And at the time I was writing my 3rd thriller, Forget Me Not, and I was kind of got to a stage where I was going, this needs something a little bit more, I'm not sure what it is. And when Liz said that to me, I thought, well, first of all, Liz really knows her stuff, she's an amazing author, and you know, if Liz says bring her back, then you bring her back. And second of all, just help me get over that little bit of writer's block. And Ingrid joined in that book in her usual sort of sneaky, do whatever she can to get the story away. So I thought it would be interesting for readers to see what drives her and what makes her so ruthless in some ways, and actually maybe even to show a bit of a human side to her.
And if you could have your pick of narrators to play Ingrid, who would you choose?
That's a really hard one, because all the narrators who've done my books have been brilliant. But Zoe Rainey is a Northern Irish actress, and she has done two of my books so far. And she's amazing. She just puts so much emotion into narrating the books. I would love to see her back taking on a bit of Ingrid. I think she could give her enough sass to get her through the role, you know.
And she, of course, has helped bring The Liar's Daughter to life.
She narrates the role of Heidi in The Liar's Daughter, and she's just great. But all the narrators on that book are quality actors, and some of them really well-established and well-known actors, particularly in Ireland. So HarperCollins pulled it out of the bag with that one. So hopefully they'll keep doing that.
Well, Claire, I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life with the listeners. But in the meantime, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and for taking us into the dark world of The Liar's Daughter.
Thank you.
All four of Claire Allen's psychological thrillers, including The Liar's Daughter, are available as talking books from the RNIB Library. And Claire will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
I'm with Janice Galloway in the RNIB Talking Books Studios in Glasgow. Now, the first time we met, you were recording Clara, and then it was, well, that was quite a while ago now.
That's a long while ago. Goodness me, I'm terrible at numbers, so I can't do the dates, but let's just say a while.
Then you were reading This Is Not About Me, mm-hmm. and you followed that up with All Made Up. Mm-hmm. Now, you call them anti-memoirs. Mm-hmm. Why?
Oh, because I'm twisted, basically. because they appear to be like memoirs, but I always think the very word memoir is quite off-putting to most people, because it sounds as though you're a retired colonel who's taken the horse and hounds out every weekend kind of thing and done that sort of thing. It's somehow, I don't know, maybe it's just its simple Frenchness, I think, makes it sound quite rather more sophisticated than what I was writing. Mm-hmm. And what I was writing was just about memories that I have of being young, growing up. And it was also called This Is Not About Me, because basically the story of my childhood wasn't about me. It was about trying to figure out what earth was wrong with my sister and how my mother stood it. And it wasn't all that much about me in my eyes at the time. Mm. But it's up to the reader to work out whether that makes any sense.
In your two memoirs, you were being reared by your mother, and Jellyfish is about child rearing. Do you think there's a connection?
I hadn't really thought about it that way, but I have a son who is now 26, and will soon be 27. This is terrifying. How did that happen? Nobody knows. And I had been writing stories about him as a wee thing, and then about his friends, and then just about the idea of children in general. So it was almost like a stockpile, and I hadn't cottoned on to, cleverly, the way you have. Mm. I wasn't able to cotton on to the fact that there might be a link between the previous books and this one. And obviously there is, because it's about real people that I really did meet and really do know by and large. But the thing about writing fiction is that you change reality in order to make it digestible for a reader or interesting for the reader. Mm. If everybody wrote down everything factual, a lot of books would be a lot more dull. So it's about paring out the bits that have nothing to do with very much and trying to lead to potential conclusions on some cases. And then the fun of meeting readers after you've done that is finding out the totally different conclusions they've reached all by themselves. Mm.
Do you find the short story form better for that, sort of making these incidents quite concise?
Mm. Well, yes, and it has that. I like writing short stories. I'm a fan of the short story form. And in my eyes, I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be more popular than it used to be, that the short story form is ideal for today. Because if you've got a set of headphones, as indeed you have now, if you've got a set of headphones and you get on the train to go to work, you can listen to a whole short story without the annoyance of, I've arrived at my destination and I've just reached an exciting bit. There's something about the short story that to me is very now and is very commuter-oriented. And since I commute a lot, since my son who now lives in London commutes a lot, I think that kind of reader is the kind of reader that I had in, that I've always had in mind somehow. The person who has less time to read than they might like.
In America, the short story is really revered. Do you think it's because of publications like The New Yorker who publish short stories and we don't have something like that?
Well, it's because some very famous writers have written short stories in the States. And there is a general assumption, not in Europe, it's in Britain in particular, that if you write short stories, you can't be up to much. What we want is a big fat book, thank you very much. The last thing I ever want is a big fat book. I mean, War and Peace is wonderful, but my God, you know, you have to be retired to actually take up reading it. So I can do it now. But I think an awful lot of people, the world is in a state of intense movement at the moment. And thank God for that. The alternative is that it slows down. Now, what's going to happen? I'm sorry to mention the Brexit word, but what's going to happen to us? I have no idea. But to me, it just seems logical to write shorter stories, almost as a kind of refuge for people who don't have much time to read but would love to read us something. Mm-hmm. And those are there. And I like writing them. They give you much more reward than writing a novel in some ways, because you have to reach a conclusion in a short time. And then you need to think of something else that reaches a conclusion in a short time. And there's a spontaneity and a fun in doing that that you don't get with a novel.
And I know you're a fan of poetry. Do you think there's a fine line between the short story and the poem?
Shortness in itself suggests a bond. People who like to express themselves in fewer words will tend to appear to have a bond, but actually poetry is a whole different ballgame in so many ways. Contemporary poetry can read like prose, and contemporary prose can read like poetry. I think we're in an age where those kind of boxes that you were meant to categorise a book inside are fading for, what should we call, the career writers. Now, that doesn't mean to say that it's fading for people who stock books and sell them in shops. They still want to call the book a something. I would seriously urge people who are fond of books in general to look beyond what you can find in a shop, look online at a place that will be stocking more esoteric books and see what else you might be missing, because there's a whole field that doesn't fall into any category now that is well worth reading and getting used to.
I know music was very important to Clara, and there are a couple of stories in Jellyfish which again have that connection to music.
Yeah, well, I'm a kind of music baby. I have liked music from I was small. My mother always sang. I had a team of aunties who sang at weddings, usually. The Giza song at the wedding thing was one I'm entirely familiar with. And it was expected, because I started to study music at school. I had a wonderful music teacher called Ken Hetherington. And he kind of showed me that music wasn't an exclusive thing at all. Whatever kind of music you like is legitimate. Now, that still seems to be problematic. I sometimes visit schools and you'll still find kids who think anything called classical music has to belong to another kind of person. Of course it doesn't. The people who wrote it were as skint as anybody. The people who played it were as skint as anybody. It's a kind of music that one time a class of people could seem to own, but now we can all have it very easily. We can all have anything these days very easily.
Now, is it important that your work is being translated into audio?
Yeah, sure it is, because people are in a rush. I mean, one of the things I think about is the commuter. This is how I get about. I get about in trains and buses, usually trains, but buses if I fancy the journey. And yes, I think people, that's the only chance some people get to read a book, because you can be kind of by yourself in a midst of people.
And obviously we're in RNIB's building as well. Some people don't have the choice as well. So it's a way of making your literature accessible to everyone.
Yeah, this has always been, I have been coming to RNIB for a long time, and it's always such a pleasure to do so, because, you know, there's a section of an audience, there's a section of people who are very keen to hear these things, and it's sometimes much more difficult to get hold of things to listen to. And it's always been an exciting thing to do, to come here.
Janice Galloway, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
There are many Janice Galloway novels in the RNIB library, many of which recorded by Janice herself. For more information, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Still to come on today's show, we'll be hearing the books of Claire Allen's life. And next up, Gail Honeyman. Interviewed the day before Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine was released. That's after this.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The Second World War caused a metal shortage, which had an unexpected effect for Talking Books listeners.
The American Foundation for the Blind sent us a gift of 500,000 gramophone needles, and of course needles became blunt. If you don't have needles to play these gramophone records, you just couldn't hear them, basically. So the blunter the needles became, the worse the sound became. So we needed new needles to keep the thing going.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to the partnership between publisher HarperCollins and RNIB, available now at the same time as the print and commercial audio versions, is the Talking Book of Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman. It's read by Catherine McCarran.
When people ask me what I do, taxi drivers, dental hygienists, I tell them I work in an office. In almost 9 years, no one's ever asked what kind of office or what sort of job I do there. I can't decide whether that's because I fit perfectly with their idea of what an office worker looks like, or whether people hear the phrase work in an office and automatically fill in the blanks themselves. Lady doing photocopying, man tapping at a keyboard. I'm not complaining. I'm delighted that I don't have to get into the fascinating intricacies of accounts receivable with them.
Gail Honeyman joined me in the RNIB Connect radio studios and told me about the book.
The book is the story of Eleanor Oliphant. She's quite an unusual young woman. She's 30 years old. She lives and works in Glasgow. She leads a very regimented life. She leads a very solitary life. She's someone who's learned how to survive, but maybe not how to live, if that makes sense. She has a chance encounter in the street with an old man who has an accident. She happens to be with a colleague, again by chance. And this one incident sets off a whole series of revelations which helps Eleanor develop and come to terms with things that have happened in her life, and we as readers find out why she is the way she is.
Mr. Gibbons is calling an ambulance, I said. So don't worry, you won't be lying here in the middle of the street for long. There's no need to be anxious. Medical care is completely free of charge in this country, and the standard is generally considered to be among the best in the world. You're a fortunate man. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to fall and bump your head in, say, the new state of South Sudan, given its current political and economic situation. But here in Glasgow, well, you've struck it lucky, if you'll pardon the pun. Raymond hung up and scuttled over. How's he doing, Eleanor? He said. Has he come round yet? No, I said, but I've been talking to him like you asked. Raymond took the man's other hand. Good old soul, he said. I nodded.
It's a slow drip. You're fed information. I remember feeling frustrated at one point. I wanted to read the social worker's report. So was that a very deliberate thing?
I wanted to try and keep the readers engaged. So I know that myself. It's when I'm reading other people's work, it's great when you feel, oh, I just have to keep reading on because I'm intrigued. There's something here that I'm not being told and I want to find out what it is. So I was trying my best to create that sort of set of circumstances in my book. Yeah, I hope it worked.
So certainly the first half of the book, it's a book about loneliness.
Yeah, I had read a newspaper article about loneliness a few years back, and one of the people they interviewed was a young woman who was in her late 20s. And she'd said she had a flat and a professional job and so on. But she said if she didn't make a special effort after she left work on Friday night, she sometimes the whole weekend would go by and she wouldn't speak to another human being until Monday morning. And I was a bit taken aback by that, because usually when we hear about loneliness, when it's discussed in the media, it's often in the context of older people, which is a huge issue, obviously. But I was intrigued that you don't usually hear about it with younger people, people in their 20s, early 30s. So I started to think about how someone could find themselves in that set of circumstances. And actually, when I thought about it, it wasn't at all difficult to think how that could come about. And so I wanted to try and show, I hope I've shown in the book, as Eleanor opens herself up to new experiences and to meeting new people, she starts to make connections, and things change so much for her because of that.
Let's slightly dance around spoiler material without giving anything away. I'm very aware we don't want to give anything away, but let's talk about mental health and the matter-of-fact way she reports on things with a sort of lack of emotion. It reminds me of other books that have featured characters who are maybe autistic or have Asperger's. Is there anything like that involved with Eleanor?
Personally, I didn't write her as a character with either of those conditions, but she does. I can see that there are some traits that you might think she shares with those, but no, I think it's more she's a survivor of some very challenging things without wanting to give away too much in the plot, and I think those have shaped her as an adult, and it's difficult to say without giving away the end. I think there's always the possibility of change.
Would you like Eleanor if you met her?
Oh, that's a great question. Would I like her? I hope I would be kind to her. She's not an easy person to like, and I was conscious of that when I was writing it. I was quite influenced by some 19th century novels, particularly Jane Eyre, when I was writing this, and rereading Jane Eyre again. I've read it several times in preparation for writing this book. I was struck as an adult by how Jane isn't a particularly likeable child when she's very young, and that in no way justifies the fact that people are cruel to her. But when she meets her aunt for the first time, I could kind of understand more as an adult that she isn't an endearing child, and she's not a people pleaser, she doesn't go out of her way to ingratiate herself with anyone. And that's all fine, as I say, and in no way justifies her subsequent mistreatment, but I was interested in that, and it was actually really fun to write a character who isn't a people pleaser, who is very direct, who appears not really to care very much what other people think about her. So as a writer, I had great fun trying to put that across in Eleanor. I hope I would like her, but then I know her better than anyone.
Other than Raymond, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
What is it about Raymond that you think drew them together?
I think Raymond is, he's a kind person, and I think small acts of kindness, everyday acts of kindness, I don't mean extravagant acts of kindness, just little things every day can actually be quite transformative in the right at the right time with the right person. And he meets Eleanor at the right time, and he's not a judgmental person as well, which I think really helps. He's happy to take her as he finds her. Yeah, he's quite easygoing, he's not easily offended. And these are all really helpful, I think, when you meet someone who can inadvertently cause offence, like Eleanor.
And perhaps he's maybe a wee bit socially awkward himself.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually. I think, he has his issues in his life, as we all do. I think he's generally quite a content person. It's a really good question, actually. I see him as being quite personable. He's very integrated in society, much more than Eleanor is or ever has been. He's been very blessed in that he's got a loving family. He had a very happy childhood. He's got some friends. He's socially integrated in a way that Eleanor hasn't, for reasons that become apparent in the book. So maybe it's to do with that.
Right, Ben, I'll see you on Monday, he said. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. He turned to leave. Raymond, wait, I said. He turned back towards me, smiling. What is it, Eleanor? The Guinness, Raymond. It was £3.50. He stared at me. It's okay, I said. There's no rush. You can give it to me on Monday, if that's easier. He counted out 4-pound coins and put them on the table. Keep the change, he said, and walked off. Extravagant. I put the money in my purse and finished my Magners. Emboldened by the apples, I decided to take a detour on the way home. Yes, why not? It was time for a spot of reconnaissance.
This is going to be a weird question, Rick. Trevor Horn, who was the sound of the 80s, was interviewed on radio about his single Video Killed the Radio Star. It wasn't released yet, but was asked by the presenter, how does it feel to have a big hit? Your book isn't released yet, but how does it feel to have a big hit?
What did Trevor Horn say?
He said, don't jinx it.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I don't know. All I can do is keep my fingers and toes crossed.
Tell us about that auction in 2015.
Well, it still doesn't actually, even when I'm saying it now, when you're saying that, it still doesn't feel quite real. I'm still pinching myself about it all. I think the whole way through, as a writer, you're sort of managing your expectations because it's, you know, it's really hard to get a book deal. It's really hard to get an agent, it's really hard to get a publisher and so on. So I just wanted to write this book. And I thought, when I get to the end, I just want to prove to myself I can write a whole novel. I can manage 80 or 90,000 words, kind of grapple with that shape of a piece of work. And if I get to the end, even if I just put it in a drawer and I never look at it again, at least I'll know, you know, I wrote a novel. And then I entered the first three chapters, which was all I had written at that point, into a competition. It's called the Lucy Cavendish Award. It's for unpublished female writers over the age of 21. And you didn't have to have finished your book, which is why I was able to enter it, because I only had three chapters. And I was shortlisted for that competition. I didn't win, but I was shortlisted, which was a fantastic experience. And it turned out that one of the judges was a literary agent, and she approached me afterwards and said she'd really liked what she'd read, and could she represent me? And I said, yes, please, that would be fantastic. So that was a real confidence boost to keep going with it, because, you know, your confidence does ebb and flow as you as you're slogging away writing it all the way through. As I say, even though these great things had happened, I was still managing my expectations, because, like I say, the whole thing is really hard to get a book published. So when I finished it and my agent said she was going to submit it to publishers, even then I was thinking, well, we'll see, you know, because even then lots of books get submitted by agents and still lots of them don't get anywhere. So when it turned out that, you know, lots of them were interested and there was an auction.
What was it, eight publishers
were trying to buy it, and then the same thing happened in the States and then in other countries as well. So I think it's sold in 28 countries now, which is, again, that doesn't feel real when I tell you that.
And I've heard Reese Witherspoon's film company is looking into it as well.
That's right, yeah. She's acquired she's optioned the film rights. That just happened last week. So that's, again, a dream come true. So excited about that.
And for a debut novel as well.
I know. It's all I can say. I'm just pinching myself. I never in my wildest dreams expected anything like this to happen with it.
Why is she called Eleanor Oliphant?
I like the resonance of it, that just, even if you knew nothing else about her apart from her name, it already starts, you can already kind of start to think about what kind of person she might be. I like the resonance of Eleanor all alone, Eleanor Rigby Oliphant. I think it's an old Scottish name. But it also sounds a little bit like elephant, so I don't know. I just like, there were all kinds of echoes and resonances in those two names together, which is why I chose it.
Now, in this edition of Read On, we're examining the titles, Chicklet and Manlet. What's your thoughts on those labels?
I'm not sure those labels are terribly helpful. I don't think it's helpful to narrow the audience for books, because who knows who's going to enjoy what type of story. I think most people are incredibly open-minded and receptive to all kinds of stories, and it's not helpful if things are in silos or if some avenues appear to be already closed off. So I'm not sure that they're particularly helpful. It's hard. I think everybody's looking for a shorthand way of describing things, but I agree with you. Sometimes it's maybe not very helpful or it's counterproductive. I don't know.
Same with this book. People, we want to pigeonhole the books, but this could be a book about loneliness, about social awkwardness, could be a romance, could be... You know, it's all of these things.
Yeah, there's a kind of a mystery as well.
Now, in the interests of spoilers, I'm going to beep some words from this next question, but... hopefully someone who's got to the end of the book has the same question and will know what I mean. At the end, why didn't and end up?
I wanted to leave readers to draw their own conclusion as to what happened next. I think the happiest outcome that Eleanor could have had, given where she started from in chapter one and where she ends up at the end, is that she's in a place where she might be able to think about having a relationship with someone. So the person, it may or may not be him.
There you go. Hopefully that answers the question without spoiling the book.
Good morning, Mr. Gibbons. My name is Miss Oliphant and I am the finance clerk. My computer has stopped working and I would be most grateful if you could see your way to repairing it today. Should you require any further details, you may reach me on extension 535. Thank you most kindly.
Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine is available in print, in audio commercially, and in audio from RNIB Talking Books. For more information on the Talking Book service, which you can receive via CD, via USB stick, or download directly to your smart device via RNIB Overdrive, head to rnib.org.uk/library.
Now it's back to Claire Allen for the books of her life. So Claire, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
In terms of falling in love with reading, it wasn't a book as much as an author, and probably like a lot of young people that were born when I was in the 70s, it was Roald Dahl. My father used to go and buy books all the time and bring them back, and on a Saturday afternoon he would read to us. I have two sisters and a brother, and he would sort of bring those books to life for us before we probably even had the ability to read them independently. And the first book that he brought in of Roald Dahl's was The Magic Finger. And I think once you get introduced to the world of Roald Dahl, you can't help but fall madly in love with it. His books are just bonkers and funny, and the bad grown-ups get their comeuppance, which makes it wonderful. So his books really gave me that love of reading. And the first book I ever consciously remember buying with my own money was Fantastic Mr. Fox. And I still remember the shop that I bought it in. I still remember the shelf that I got it off. It just made such a big impression on me. And that sort of set me up for a lifetime of being a complete nutter bookworm.
This time, we must go in a very special direction, said Mr. Fox, pointing sideways and downward. So, he and his four children started to dig once again. The work went much more slowly now. Yet they kept at it with great courage, and little by little the tunnel began to grow.
"Dad, I wish you would tell us where we are going."
"I dare not do that," said Mr. Fox, "because this place I am hoping to get to is so marvellous that if I described it to you now, you would go crazy with excitement. And then, if we fail to get there, which is very possible, you would die of disappointment. I don't want to raise your hopes too much, my darlings." For a long, long time they kept on digging. For how long they did not know, because there were no days and no nights down there in the murky tunnel. But at last, Mr. Fox gave the order to stop. "I think," he said, "we'd better take a peep upstairs now and see where we are. I know where I want to be, but I can't possibly be sure we're anywhere near it." Slowly, wearily, the foxes began to slope the tunnel up towards the surface. Up and up it went, until suddenly they came to something hard above their heads and they couldn't go up any further. Mr. Fox reached up to examine this hard thing. "It's wood," he whispered.
Wooden planks. What does that mean, Dad?
It means, unless I am very much mistaken, that we are right underneath somebody's house, whispered Mr. Fox.
Be very quiet now while I take a peek.
John Cormack narrating Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
The book that I go back to reread the most, and which I love, and I know that it's always going to put me in a great mood, and it's going to make me laugh, and it's going to make me cry and then laugh again, is The Wonderful Rachel's Holiday by Marion Keyes. It was the first book of Marion's that I read, and I was 21 at the time, and I remember thinking that real sense of, I've not read anything like this before. It's laugh out loud funny, but it has a really, really serious message behind it. You never feel as if you're being preached at. You just feel as if you're going along in this wonderful journey with Rachel and her family. And of course, that's the wonderful Walsh family who Marion writes about so well. So that is a real comfort blanket of a book for me.
How are you getting on with this crowd of head cases? Neil jerked his head round the room at the brown jumpers. A warmth filled me, a normal person. They're okay, I giggled, for a crowd of head cases. And what did you make of Josephine?
She's a bit scary, I admitted.
Ah, she's another head case, he said. She puts thoughts in people's minds, make them admit to things that aren't true.
Really? I said. You know, I thought she was a bit odd.
Yeah, you'll see for yourself, he said intriguingly. Anyway, what are you in for?
Drugs. I made a rueful face to let him know that there wasn't really anything wrong with me. He laughed understandingly.
I know what you mean. I'm in for alcohol myself. My poor deluded wife doesn't drink, and she thinks that because I have 4 pints on a Saturday night, it makes me an alcoholic. I came in here to get her off my back. At least now, it'll prove to her there's nothing wrong with me.
And we laughed together conspiratorially at other people's foolishness. A couple of times during the day, I noticed the sauerkraut and Celine, the day nurse, talking about me. At tea time, just before the chips fest, Celine appeared and said, "Can I have a word, Rachel?" Impending doom descended, while the inmates shouted, "Ooh, Rachel, you've done it now," and "Can I have your chips?" Celine took me head lowered to the nurse's room. It was like being taken to the principal's office at school, but to my surprise, Celine didn't seem to be annoyed with me. "You don't look well," she said. "You haven't looked well all day." "I didn't get much sleep last night," I exhaled, euphoric with relief. "And I think I might still be jet-lagged." "Why didn't you say anything?"
Marie McCarthy narrating Rachel's Holiday by Marianne Keyes, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
There's so many amazing books out this year. It's quite tough to actually pick one to go, this is the one I'm going to recommend. But I have to go with Beyond the Big Blue Sky by Irish author Anna McPartland. It's the follow-up to The Last Days of Rabbit Hayes, which is one of my all-time favourite books. And it follows the Hayes family after Rabbit passes away in the first book. And it follows their sort of year after Rabbit's death and how they come to terms with it. Again, what Anna does so brilliantly is that she creates these real life, living, breathing characters that you can just relate to, that you feel as if you're sitting beside the whole way through the book. And you can be laughing your head off one page and then absolutely breaking your heart the next. And I just find it a really cathartic, moving, wonderful book. I knew even from the first page that I was in safe hands and this was going to be something that I was really going to enjoy, and I did. So I cannot recommend that book more.
Davy had abandoned singer-songwriter Casey's American tour 9 days earlier when the call came that Rabbit was being transferred to a hospice. He knew instantly it was the end, unlike his insane parents, who tried to find a cure and or miracle up until the last second. Casey supported him abandoning the tour. Davy was more than her drummer. They'd been close friends for too many years to count. She assured him she would be fine,
and that his drum tech knew the set inside out. "Don't get too used to him," he'd said. "No chance," she'd said. It was comforting because 9 days ago his job as Casey's drummer was all he had. Davey had a strong support network in Nashville. It was half the reason he'd fought his family and begged his sister for the chance to raise her 12-year-old daughter. It wasn't his plan or intention to put himself forward as guardian, but over the course of the 8 long days and nights watching his sister die and being party to the arguments as to who was fit to care for Juliet, also known to those who loved her most as Bunny, he thought, why not me? His parents, Jack and Molly, were too old. His sister Grace had 4 boys already packed into a tiny house. Why not the guy with more money than sense? No wife, no kids, and a hole in his life to fill. Anyway, the child picked him. They'd always had a special, close relationship conducted from afar. She knew he had room for her in his home and heart. What she didn't know was how impulsive, selfish, clueless, and messed up he was. In her final days, Rabbit agreed to Davy caring for her daughter. The rest of the family were up in arms, but she was steadfast. Just love her, Davy. That's all anyone really needs. Of course, the cancer had gone into her brain by then.
Simon Kirby narrating Below the Big Blue Sky by Anna McPartlin, which is available commercially. Well, Claire Allen, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.